This is Price Talks, another meat and sizzle edition. That means Rob Sizzle McDowell.
Yes, yes, yeah. Rob McDowell's here.
Gord
the sizzle.
Price, I'm not even going to say it.
No, the meat.
Yeah, but with our special guest.
Yeah.
And Pete Fry. Doesn't that fit well with meat and sizzle?
Oh, I guess it does, too. Okay, I was going to say, where do I fit in this whole meat and sizzle? But yeah, Fry, there you go.
Hey, fresh from council, except I can't believe you're fresh. I mean, dude, this is relentless.
We were lucky to get you today.
You were, and you know, actually, it's funny. We just had this conversation with our staff that we've gone through our entire annual food budget last month. So they feed us when we do a full, as you know, when we do a full day, they feed us. One of those outrageous perks. But we've gone through the food budget already. And we've done more member motions in the first 6 months than the last council did in four years.
Your caring constituents are actually concerned about this. Mm-hmm. How is this, you know, how are you handling it?
Well, and, you know, and actually, it was brought up by a few people who aren't, I wouldn't say in my caring constituent realm, but they were actually very thoughtful. And they were like, you guys don't get paid enough to do this. And
right.
How are you doing?
No, it has nothing to do with how much you get paid. You shouldn't have
run if you were expecting that. They
just, yeah, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing okay. You know what the one upside is? There is a real genuine camaraderie and collegiality there at council because there's no one majority. So we actually have found that we have to work together. And there's not a lot of real bitter background stuff. And so we can come out of there. And, you know, I just went for drinks with a couple of counselors yesterday and after council because we got out early and we were so happy we went to the patio at Milestones and cross-partisan, just, you know, and that didn't happen in the past council.
Do you continue to be impressed by how long and strong the collegiality remains, or are you somewhat suspicious?
The 14 hours a day, it's similar, to what happened before, but there isn't that sense of powerlessness and frustration that's displayed on the floor that used to be displayed. And even back to Susan Anton, when she was the only person there and she put forward motions and no one would second them, that sort of thing. You rarely see that until just recently. But you have these
couple times we've had
motions thrown out there and nobody seconded them. But there's these five parties and they're all jockeying. But what you do see is everyone's kind of virtue signaling, if you could say, or playing to their base, or everyone has to sort of be responsible to their constituency, which creates, I think, these motions that get put forward from COPE, from MPA, from the Greens, from One City, just because they need to represent to their people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and bearing in mind that we've all been, you know, we've spent the last 10 years out in the wilderness with an absolute vision majority and an inability to do anything that we wanted to bring forward or our constituents wanted to bring forward. So we do have to make up for lost time.
Right.
Maybe not all in the first 6 months, but but it seems that we're racing to do a lot of stuff, and that does create its challenges, for sure.
Did you sense that there's also a bit of jockeying for sort of power in this hierarchy that, you know, it's basically pretty flat, but people want to establish that they're the A-list, they're, you know, on top, they're the apex of this. So Alpha counselor.
Yeah, I see that within the NPA. There's a lot of that going on.
Not within the Greens, the three of you?
No.
Really?
No. Okay. Honestly, not. No, actually, we you know, I think Adrian's just really relieved to have Mike and I turn out to be pretty solid and good assets for her. So it's taken a lot of the pressure off of her being the lone green. So I think she's just really relieved. And Mike and I have a kind of a brother relationship. We get along really well. And so, no, there's not really. We have our different interests as well.
Yeah. When I was on council, Gordon Campbell, when he was mayor, would come in and ask, hey, what do you want to get done this year? Choose one, maybe two. So I'm asking Pete Fry, counselor. What do you want to get done this year, Pete? What's your priority?
Well, you know, housing obviously is a priority and changing that paradigm a little bit.
Everyone wants
me
to
personally,
do that.
Yeah. You know, I live in Strathcona and I've lived in and around the downtown east side for the last 30 years. And I really want to see us make some progress on that. And some people have thought, well, that's kind of a big hill to climb. But it is where I live and it's where I'm mostly accountable.
How would you know at the end of your 4 years?
That I accomplished something there. I would get that feedback from folks that live in my community.
Is there something physically you could measure that would tell you?
Oh, I think just reducing. I mean, I don't know if you've spent any time in the downtown east side lately, but certainly the spillover into Chinatown, we see it as you know, it's boarding up shops, it's boarding up even just access points of egress for people. You know,
less boards,
less kind of lawlessness. I was in my little barbershop. And a guy walked in and just brazenly walked in. And I knew he was up to something. And I sort of stood up because they're all old Chinese folks and they're small and frail. And he was a pretty big guy. And then he saw me and just nonchalantly walked away. And then the woman afterwards explained to me that he walked in a couple of days before, just looked around, grabbed her cell phone, and walked out the room.
Wow.
And I hear that a lot from, you know, folks down there.
Are you talking about gentrification of the downtown east side?
No. I'm just talking about just, you know, it doesn't have to be quite so lawless and chaotic. I'm actually, I've got, I'm doing a bunch of visits because I got a little extra time. I'm going down to Oppenheimer Park tomorrow just to talk to folks. And there's, you know, and this isn't the gentrifying folks. This is like low income housing for families that are really stressed. I don't want to name buildings specifically because they feel like they're under siege. And that's not right. And, you know, a lot of my work has been with low income families around Raycam and McLean Housing and Strathcona. And these are extremely vulnerable families and people who just want the same kind of opportunities as the rest of us and want their kids to have better lives and want to be able to catch a bus and feel safe at the bus stop. And that's really eroding. And I've never seen it as bad as it is now. So I'd like to see some headway on that.
And do you see with the viaduct plan for this, are you going to be happy with what the staff are going to recommend in terms of the East-West connector and thus changes to the infrastructure and how it'll affect that neighborhood?
I haven't been happy at all.
And how are you going to deal with that? Because
So ironically, I was on a plane coming back from FCM along with most of the fellow counselors who'd gone to FCM when staff held a briefing on their next moves on the arterial. So I was a little miffed because they all know that, I mean, as most people know, that's my raison d'etre for even getting into politics was the whole issue of viaducts removal and what that looked like as far as traffic impacts east of Maine. And so I was really disappointed that, I didn't get an opportunity to be part of that briefing, and there's a report back coming in the fall. But I sent back a pretty clear memo of where I think that they've gone wrong and my expectations and an indication that this is a big issue for me and this is my hill that I'll fight on if I have to.
But you were also involved for 2 years on the downtown east side.
I was on the downtown east side local area plan. Yep.
And how did you feel about your involvement with that? How did that come out? Was that a positive experience for you?
The day they signed off on the downtown east side local area plan after 4 days of hearings was the day I decided to run for city council. So I was extremely disappointed and frustrated.
Yeah, no kidding. You said that at the beginning of the debate on the citywide plan.
Yeah.
You didn't want to feel like you felt in 2014. You didn't say what that was.
Well, it wasn't just me. It was a lot of, it was the entire group of people. It was, you know, a couple of dozen of us who had gone and participated for 2 years in good faith, tried to move across bridges. And that was the amazing thing. That process managed to unite all these disparate interests in the downtown east side and unite them in opposition to the plan because we felt that we didn't get. So first and foremost, the definition of social housing was quite literally prepared on the back of a napkin by vision counselors and presented after 4 days of public hearings. We asked for it repeatedly through the entire planning process. We never once did we get an actual definition of what that social housing would look like. And what does that mix? We had the Coriolis group had done a pro forma about what the development kind of, what we needed for development in that part of town to achieve those whatever goals we wanted. And we never got to see that. So there was a lot of pieces that were missing. And we felt like we were used as window dressing.
Right.
And that's my concern with, you know, planning processes in general. And I think that was also the case with the community panel in Strathcona for the arterial.
Why is that not going to happen with city plan?
Because I honestly think that that's not the will of council. I think that we don't want to see that happen very explicitly and specifically. So I would be incredibly, well, disappointed sounds like not even forceful enough. I'd be very angry if that was the outcome of this planning process. And I don't think it has to be. And I don't think that's the intent of staff. I do think that, under Gil Kelly, senior planning staff have come and sat down with each of the counselors individually, you know, for half hour sessions, several of them at a time. So, you know, I've done several sessions iterating through their machinations as they're trying to get to a place where they're scoping what this planning process might look like. And it's just the scoping of the process. So I do feel that they're listening to what the council is saying. And individually, they're talking to us individually, right?
So we're in the process, or the process.
Yeah.
To discuss eventually a process to get to a physical plan.
Yeah, well, and I think through my conversations with them, it's really about starting from like that 1,000-mile view. Or 1,000-yard view, and we're looking down, and we're trying to get a big picture sense of where people's hopes and aspirations are for the future of the city. And then we start refining it from there. It's that inverted pyramid kind of idea.
Yeah, but if we talk about that 1,000 whatever meter view, whatever you want to call it, with all those lenses. So those lenses were never more on display than the cycle of amendments that came up when you had the approval on Wednesday night for the city plan. And everyone wanted to have their own lenses put on it, which seemed to be fine, aside from one of the councillors that had a bit of problems. But for yourself, you had your amendment included social justice. It was a word that I'd never heard of. Equanimous,
yeah.
Co-creative, place-based. Can you expand upon that?
Well, so the co-creative, this is interesting. You know, this was based on a conversation that I had a long time ago with a city planner, back when I was really frustrated with the viaducts removal originally.
Yeah.
And we went for a beer, and she asked me, well, what's your problem? What is it that you guys want? You know, we're doing all this work. And I explained it. I'm like, we want to be part of the process. We want to help design this. We want to have a say. And she's like, oh, you don't mean consultation. You mean co-creation. And there was a penny drop moment. I'm like, oh, wait a second. Is that planner speak? Is that consultation? And apparently consultation is putting sticky notes on a wall, and co-creation is something entirely different.
Oh, yeah. What is it?
Well, co-creation is a collaborative effort where we're working together and we're...
That's stickers on a wall. What does co-creative really mean?
Well, we work together to create something.
Same thing. Stickers on a wall.
No,
Sounds like you want to actually write the thing.
Well, not me personally.
Well...
But co-creative with the people of Vancouver. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's. I mean,
so if I get to write this thing.
Well, no, okay, I'm not exactly writing, but I think there's a cynical kind of consultation where it is sticky notes on a wall, and that's how we felt coming out of the Downtown Eastside local area plan. We got to share our feelings in sticky notes on a wall, and they took it and dutifully recorded it, but it never felt like we were invested or even incorporated.
But isn't
the
danger just the opposite? I'm going to walk into this. You, Pete Fry, said it's co-creative. I get to write this thing.
Well, it's co-creative with 636,000 people.
All right.
So it's not...
So I have reason to be cynical.
Well, I mean, be cynical as you will, but I think that
you're telling me on one hand, I'm going to be... The planners don't get to write the thing. We, the people, get to write it, or at least co-write it.
No. I think co-creative is the process that gets us there. At the end of the day, again, coming back to the inverted pyramid...
Rob, can we have that, any difference?
Well, it's like curated by the staff, and then...
Well, we get that
we
big
have input
picture.
To so it
the
or?
Big picture, top of the inverted pyramid, the wider 1,000-yard view, and...
We did that with City Plan.
Yeah, well, and City Plan is largely what we sort of look to as a good model.
All right.
Yeah.
So this is no different?
I would say it's probably
in a sense,
different.
As usual.
I think City Plan was more heavily invested in the sort of neighborhood identities, and I think that those neighborhood identities may not be as well framed as they were during City Plan.
I'm trying to understand what you didn't like about the last experience with the Downtown Eastside Plan. So was it the political nature of it at the end, that sort of insertion of political, what you saw as political will into the, and how will that not happen this
so
time?
I think the feeling that we came out of Downtown Eastside Local Area Plan was that the plan had mostly already been written and that we were part of a window dressing process.
Political insiders or... Staff or a team?
I mean, it was very opaque.
Not you guys.
It was not a process that was really engaging the citizenry in that way that we were led to believe we were being a part of a process. And I think a lot of us came out of it feeling like we were actually used as window dressing to make it seem legitimate, whereas we didn't really feel that we had that.
Because, I mean, if you think of the West End plan, the Marple plan, what was the other plan that was just done?
The Grandview Woodlands plan.
You hear the same thing from about everyone that was involved with all those plans. So I'm not sure how we can come to a more genuine, without being too naive, how can we come to that place that you want to be, that you expect to be, that you would be happy to be at
the
end
of city. You get from 30,000 feet down to a physical on-the-ground plan.
Yeah, and I think that's that first phase of it where we do that more organic kind of approach. Whereas, I mean, the Downtown Eastside Local Area Plan was a curated group membership of who was on that committee. The Grandview Woodland Local Area Plan was a quote-unquote random selection of citizens that came to represent a panel that worked on it. And there was opportunities for the general public to put sticky notes on the boards and reflect what they thought of the emerging directions. And that I think, I mean, I will still be investing in lots of sticky notes for this process. There'll be a lot of sticky notes, I'm sure. But we want it to be something more fulsome, and really want people to have an opportunity to feel that they're expressing their hopes.
Oh, I think we can do that. Yeah, I can pretty much tell you what it's going to be too. We want more, and we want better. But no big tax increase.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's some people who want less. I think
less crime, less litter. Okay, but you know what I mean.
less growth. That's what we hear. There's a counselor. One of our counselors is very adamant about that. That we need to relook at the entire metrics of population growth and focus on livability. And I don't want to say pull up the drawbridge, but certainly that we have enough. I think that we have enough zoned capacity already, and we don't need to change.
Please address that one. Elizabeth Murphy, every single column in The Sun says essentially the same thing. Yes. There's existing zone, more than existing zone capacity to handle the predicted growth.
Right.
Why is she wrong?
Well, and I think we all know that that's on the notion that all that existing zone capacity could just magically be unlocked without having to build new. I mean, it's talking about, we could add basement suites and tertiary suites and this, that, and the other. But I don't think that that's actually a realistic proposition, because not everybody's going to do that with a single family home, and not every single family home is an ideal candidate for that. And, you know, I think what we need to be is a bit more purposeful and look at opportunities to build housing that's affordable. And I don't think that the zoned capacity argument necessarily considers housing affordability.
Pete, that's a really bad response, because it doesn't tell me that she's wrong.
Well, I mean, I categorically don't. I think she is wrong, and I don't think that the zoned capacity, the existing zone capacity, will achieve the housing affordability that we need to, you know, and just it will not undo the scarcity of housing that we are experiencing now.
I would love to hear that said categorically with the data or the numbers, the map, to illustrate it. Because I think it's a pretty powerful argument.
That we have enough zone capacity.
Well, either you do or you don't. If your growth rate is about 2% per year, and here's the available capacity under the existing zoning bylaws, and as she argues, you've got more than enough. Why are you going, how much more do you need to add? And is it going to solve affordability? Can you give me some assurance? Let me take a step back here. I know you're not going to be able to give me numbers on this, but surely you can give me some kind of range. How much more capacity are we looking at? Do we need to double the amount of
assertion that we have enough zone capacity is not mine. I'm not making that assertion. That's a question for Elizabeth Murphy, and that I would challenge her to produce the maps that show where that's
on Elizabeth Murphy.
Actually, I'm on his side.
Exactly the job of a planner.
I'm on his side on this one.
but I'm not a planner, and I mean, but I think that she's made that claim many times, so that she should show us.
I'd like you to ask the planners to explain it.
I'm not going
to
waste planners' time on that.
I think this is an essential argument, and I think she makes it repeatedly because it's effective. And a lot of people are going to grab it, particularly when you get into the neighborhoods. My neighborhood, the West End, we've just gone through a plan. We're seeing a lot of new capacity being added. Is it enough? In other words, are we going to be exempt, us in the West End, and perhaps these other plans that you've just, Northeast Falls Creek, Joyce Collingwood, Falls Creek Flats, Grandview Woodland, Marple, downtown Eastside, are they going to be exempt from having to take on the responsibility of any more capacity? You, after all, in the big picture, are looking for where we're going to find places to accommodate new growth. Are you going to exempt the neighborhoods that have gone through this planning process already?
I think there's more to that than just accepting growth. It's also the kind of growth. So you mentioned Joyce Collingwood. That's a great example. If you take a look at what's happening in Joyce Collingwood right now, and there's some neat things happening, but there's also a lot of the housing form are, you know, bachelors and one bedrooms. Now, if you look at the Joyce Collingwood neighborhood and a lot of the existing single family home vernacular that's there, there's a lot of Filipino families there. They're big family units. They're not bachelor and one bedroom families. These are families that need a little bit more space. I don't think we're addressing the needs of that existing community. And if the intention is to just squeeze them out and send them to somewhere else, then that's not been articulated, and I think that's the wrong direction to take that.
Speaking as a parochial West Ender, is my neighborhood exempt?
Exempt from
having to find additional capacity for growth.
I would personally advocate for a none. I think that the West End plan needs a closer look. I think that we have not done a good job of achieving the right kind of housing supply and the new supply, and I think that we're in danger of losing a lot of what makes the West End great by focusing on that kind of luxury housing market that is coming at the expense of affordable housing.
No neighborhood exempt, regardless of the planning process they've had in the last 10 years.
I mean, exempt. I mean, no, I think this is a citywide plan. So we're looking at it. We're taking a look at everything. I don't think it's fair to say that we're not going to look at the West End and we're going to look at everybody but the West End or...
And Marple. And Grandview Woodland.
Yeah, no, I would say that everything, that's the whole idea of this citywide plan.
So regardless of what the work that's been done on these plans?
I would say regardless of, it may layer on top of that. It may come back that, you know, the plan did not really address the overall community need. I've certainly heard from enough people.
Don't you think, Rob, they can't accept any neighborhood?
They can't accept that any neighborhood?
Can't. The moment you accept, say, the West End.
Yeah. Right.
Isn't all the other neighborhoods going to be more or less in line?
Right.
Yeah.
We don't want to have to go through the pain
Yeah.
of having to find the places where we're going to accommodate, even if it's different kinds of housing.
And so I don't think that the West End gets exempt. But that being said, we've already done some work in the West End, and it may be possible to layer on top of that. I mean, we don't need to revisit maybe the demographic data that we compiled during the West End area plan.
Do we get a de facto veto if we don't like it?
No. What would a de facto veto look like?
No, we don't believe we have to take additional growth or this kind of
growth.
But
who's we?
Neighborhood, the community, the people you want to consult. The co-creators.
Yeah, I mean, if there was an overwhelming position that came out of that, I think that it would have to be considered on its merits. Now, I mean, that's a pretty broad what if. So, but no, I don't think the veto kind of stuff is coming from the West End anyway. I think we're more apt to see vetoes from some more comfortably ensconced neighborhoods that are less dense.
You're talking about the West Side?
In parts of it, yeah, sure.
Dunbar, West Point, Gray,
Called in Hardwick territory.
Well, actually, you know, I think Kitsilano is probably a little bit more adept to change and is more accepting of that kind of change.
Hmm. You guys just spent 6 hours and turned down 21 townhouses on Granville, trying to get a 7-story rental building. Looks like it's going to be painful.
Well, the one on Fraser, I wasn't
there. At the rate you're going.
I wasn't there for the Fraser one. I actually would have voted in favor of that Fraser one.
Right, but at the rate you're going, you're never going to ever get close to even the existing targets.
Well, you know what's interesting, Gordon, is that we're starting to hear from developers that they're adjusting to this new council and maybe trying to achieve a little bit better housing affordability and a little bit more public benefit than they were coming to the table with before. So we might see some changes yet. I don't think, you know, it's early days, and we're certainly sending a signal that that this council is interested in seeing some other things, and chief among them being, like, you know, housing affordability and bringing in that kind of...
You got to find space for 5,500 people a year.
Yeah.
But under the existing growth rate. And you want to accommodate a city for everyone. If everyone means everyone, and I show up from some other place and can't afford the existing housing, is there a place for me? And if there is, I think your growth rate's going to be a bit more than 5,500.
Mm. If we build too much affordable housing.
No, if you provide at least some hope that there will be a place for me. Anyone. Don't we actually use affordability as a way of limiting growth, which is already at 1.8%? If you actually do seriously address the problem of affordability, can't you reasonably expect you got a lot more people you're going to have to accommodate?
Yeah, that is the potential challenge of addressing affordability, but I'd probably like to see us do a better job of addressing affordability before we start worrying about doing too good a job of addressing affordability.
Fair enough. But at least you've got a note. You have now what will probably be the biggest developer, maybe in the region, certainly in Vancouver, MST Corporation and whatever the Indigenous people decide to do.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, they're looking at just in one relatively small parcel, 3,000 units. Is that actually going to be the only hope you seriously got to provide for housing on the scale that you need?
I think, you know, we'll see a lot of stuff happening in along the Canby corridor and along the Broadway corridor ultimately as that starts to frame
ultimately
out. Well, I mean, I say Canby corridor because that's more active in the immediate And then as the Broadway corridor starts to evolve, with TransLink obviously as partners in what that looks like.
Give me a time frame here. This plan won't even really be seriously discussed until after the next election.
No, we're hoping to see it before the election. Now it will the aftermath and outcome of it will
won't be a physical plan.
It won't be if you're saying a physical plan, like actually.
I want to be able to look at a map and see what you've got in mind for my neighborhood.
I think that there's a reasonable choice of that.
You go into an election with the prospect of a physical plan.
We've made it clear that we want to have something. We want to have this plan, sort of the nuts and bolts of it.
So the election could be the referendum on the plan. Is that what you envision?
Yeah. We don't want to see this not through before.
I think that's a very big deal right there. Yeah. You just said that there will be something that we as the constituents will be able to look at in our neighborhood, a map that will tell us where growth is being proposed, and we'll have a chance to vote on that effectively civic election.
I hesitate to frame it as a referendum, but I think it'll be a clear indication of where we're going with things.
I worry that it'll be...
For every neighborhood in the city. There's never been anything like that.
Well, Harland Bartholomew, apparently.
Yeah. We saw how the TransLink referendum went, right? That was sort of
not a good precedent.
A similar kind of question that went out to people.
Yeah, no, and I mean it's a bold move for this council, and it's certainly, but it's what we all kind of ran on. So we're obliged to at least follow through on that and say how we are changing a course.
So, Gil, if you're listening to this, our chief planner, get ready, dude.
Well, he's ready. He's ready. He's pretty excited.
Physical plan.
Yeah.
There's going to be a map. I can see where the growth is going.
You know, I can
see what the trade-offs have been. I'm going to know what they got in mind for my neighborhood.
Well, you know, and I have this anecdote that nobody seems to like about the plan, and it's like going to see the dentist. You can't just do it once every 20 years and expect it to be okay. We actually have to do regular checkups and keep this thing moving. The plan is not a once and done kind of plan. This is an ongoing maintenance.
This is root canals on every tooth at the same time.
Well, yeah. I hear the campaign slogan now. Yeah.
Well, and Kennedy doesn't like it because the mayor thinks it's like, this will be way more fun than going to the dentist. Come on. And we do want to make it fun. You know, part of the intent here is to really get people sort of feeling passionate about the city. Again, and people have been jaded and bitter about the city for the last little while. And this is an opportunity to feel some hope and some passion and some.
You've been reading your Twitter feed too much.
Are you kidding? I'm so off Twitter. Oh,
the opposite Twitter,
Yeah, I would be such a curmudgeon if I'd been reading my Twitter feed too
much. How are you going to reach those people, though, that you want to reach?
The Twitter people?
No, the non-Twitter people. Is, you know, that mushy middle that are out there that are really disengaged from how the city operates. And that's a huge challenge. It sounds really expensive, actually, trying to reach them. Adequately.
Yeah, well, and that's part of what this original scoping will come out of. I mean, you know, I know City Plan did like more of a direct mail approach, and I think obviously we have a lot more digital tools now at our disposal. But, you know, we talk about like charrettes in a box kind of idea. We talk about working with school board and like finding some kind of school programming where we really want to get kids engaged in this.
Right.
One of the things that Councilor Dominato and I have been talking a lot about is like, how do we get like a kids forum where we can actually have kind of a fun event where parents and families can go with their kids and kind of like, you know how kids' cartoons and stuff have like, it's geared for kids, but then there's some adult humor spiked in there to make it kind of like more relevant.
We did that at Robson Square for City Plan. It was great.
There you go, right? See, like there's opportunities to make it fun, make it hopeful, get people really engaged and like, yeah, man, this is my city and I'm part of it. And that's what we want to get people feeling, that it's not the developers running the show, that it's not, you know, some secret cabal of you know, donors and politicians. And
but you're going to have to try and reach those single working parents, those people out there. You're going to get all the seniors that you need. Sorry, Gord. But you're going to get all the seniors that you need. How are you going to get everybody else?
Well, young man.
It sounds really expensive.
Yeah. The young man over
Thank
here.
Thank you, Pete.
Yeah. Thanks, Pete.
Hey, I was wondering, do I represent the old white guys? I think I can pull out my LGBTQ card.
Yeah.
But do I have to be a traditionally unrepresented voice to be heard?
We're certainly wanting to make sure that those voices are heard.
Yeah. No, but I'm talking about the old white guys.
Well, they'll
we're
find a way to be heard.
We're feeling a little beaten up these days.
The old white guys are feeling beaten up?
Yeah. Really? I love that what I read on Twitter today. Can't be racist against an old white guy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the... We got the old white guy down south of the border, and he seems to be emboldening lots of...
We don't talk about that.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
But seriously, another way of thinking about this, the people who pay a good part of the taxes of the city, the homeowners, particularly the rich homeowners, I think they're maybe feeling, our voice actually isn't being respected. We don't really see our voice being reflected in the way that you're phrasing this. Build equity into the process to ensure traditionally underrepresented voices are heard, respected, and reflected. I think there's a feeling of a lack of respect.
Well, I've certainly heard that articulation, but I've also heard a lot of folks talking ruefully about not being able to see their grandkids because they can't afford to live in the city, and that their kids are moving elsewhere because they can't afford to live in the city, and that they're resentful that their little neighborhood high street has withered away and all that's left is a Tim Hortons and a Starbucks and all the neat little things that made them happy about their neighborhood high street are gone.
And that's the reason why we want to tax you more.
Well, I mean, I think that's, where we have to work on sound policy, right? And like try and find ways to make those complete communities and find ways to tease out what it is that those people want aside from like, of course, everybody wants less taxes. Yeah. But there's other things that people want aside from lower taxes.
Yeah, I want more and better.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what hopefully the city plan will tease out and get past. I mean, I do think that a lot of the, we do hear on various different issues, like be it in the downtown east side, be it in South Vancouver, be it on the west side, we hear the same voices often. There's certain people who are self-appointed spokes leaders of communities that have the loudest voices. And I don't think that that's necessarily democratic or really accurate reflection of, case in point, my visit tomorrow to Oppenheimer Park. I know what I'm going to hear because I've been getting advance word from these folks and their voices aren't being heard. There's people who are saying, don't touch Oppenheimer Park. It's fine. It's safe. It's, and there's people who are saying otherwise and who have less powerful voices in this conversation. And people who are equally marginalized, people who are poor, people who are struggling, people who are vulnerable, who aren't being heard. So I think that we always have to be mindful of who's being heard and who's not being heard. And I think that that's part of
Oh, this council is way mindful of the people who aren't being heard.
Well, it's
that's pretty much what we hear almost exclusively.
Well, that's a good thing though, right?
I suppose it is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that there are, what I'm saying is...
You're expecting now the people who traditionally have been heard. Let's listen to the people who haven't been heard, but we do expect you to pay more to help us solve these problems.
Well, I would put it to you that Elizabeth Murphy is not the only voice coming out of West Point Grey.
Yes.
She's also
Colleen Hardwick.
Nor is Colleen Hardwick the only voice coming out of West Point Grey. I can tell you in all truthfulness that I've pounded the pavement in Point Grey during the election. I've talked to all sorts of people and there are a myriad of voices that do not reflect that same opinion. Now, that opinion may be well organized and well articulated and gets op-eds in the Sun and gets, By the way, did you guys see that? Sorry, kind of shift gears a little bit, but that great caricature of Sadu in the Common Ground. Did you guys not see that?
I did not see that.
I just thought it was a bit homophobic, actually.
So was the original. The original where Gregor was in bed with the big unions of big developers and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Kennedy Stewart in bed with developers and the big unions, and they're just getting out of bed, and Sadu has the whip, and he's done up as a dominatrix, shall I say?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, he's got boots and a cape, and...
It kind of bugged me as a gay man.
But the bondage discipline thing is really actually technically kind of a desexualized thing anyway. It's, if you go in for that kind of kink, it's not all about sex. So is it homophobic? Is it just master and servant? I don't know.
Well, there's a bed and he's in bed and they're
okay. You
brought it up.
I know, but that was because they did that. Jeff Olson did it in The Courier with Gregor Robertson.
Right.
So, yeah. But anyway, that was a bit of a digression.
I want to go back, though, to, it was really Mike Harcourt, just as Mike can often do, gives you these kind of jaw-dropping observations. So it's really most of the residential growth in the city for the next decade or so could be west of Alma, west of Alma. And it will, of course, be predominantly on the lands either basically under MST, Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh Development Corporation, already partnered with Canada Lands for the development of Jericho. And we are talking thousands and thousands of units. Can that go ahead, Jericho, independent of the city plan?
I'm not sure what the legal status of it is, but I believe it can, yeah. Yeah, I don't think that they're obliged. I think they've come to the city and want to be partners and want to work together, but I know that the Squamish at SNOC with West Bank, they are apparently not obliged to deliver any community benefits or CACs. They're not obliged to the Vancouver Building Bylaw, and that's actually creating a bit of a wrinkle for Vancouver Fire Rescue Services because they're saying, well, we're not going to service these guys if they're not obliged to the Vancouver Building Bylaw. So there is clearly there's a legal sort of framework that does preclude direct city involvement or oversight. Now, that being said, my understanding...
Thousands and thousands of units, potentially.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars of value, which will come out of the real estate of the city of Vancouver and be directed to something around 6,000 people who have no accountability to the voters of the city.
Well, that also raises an interesting question if they're going to be able to vote. If people living on that land will be eligible to vote in the city of Vancouver. I have no idea.
I don't think that penny has dropped.
Yeah. Mm. And that's, I mean, that is an ongoing conversation. And I would say that, you know, and the previous.
But this is going to occur independent of the city plan.
No. The intention is certainly to weave it into the city plan. Now, to what degree they will be obliged to consider that, I guess, remains to be seen. But I would say that the majority of council have taken a good faith approach to working with the MST and the urban Indigenous population, for that matter, in the spirit of reconciliation and the TRC recommendations. I mean,
was that discussed specifically during the discussions on the city plan and also the Squamish development around the Broad Bridge?
I mean, certainly in our individual conversations, and we've had council to council meetings. And I mean, with the exception of Councillor Hardwick, we've all been pretty clear on where we stand on reconciliation and the TRC recommendations and our role as a city, right? And role as a province, as a country, but as a city and as individuals, we all have a role to play in TRC.
What does decolonization mean?
Yeah, that's a good question because, I mean, I'm of a colony background and a colonial myself, and it's a very complicated thing to unpack. So I'm not sure what it means in a long-term vision context, but I think in the immediate and when we talk about how we frame reconciliation, I mean, I think it does mean, you mentioned earlier, check your privilege. So I think it means recognizing where colonialism has upheld certain aspects of privilege.
Change the name of Trutch Street? Remove statues?
I'm sorry to say I'm not 100% up to speed on this, the history of Trutch.
Let me be provoked. Very unpleasant.
Well, then, yeah, sure.
Pretty bad.
If he's a bad person, then yeah, why not? I see no reason to maintain it.
Since the colonial
project. I'll take your word for it, of course. I haven't done that background myself, so I'm not going to.
Yeah. It doesn't take much. What about changing the name of the city?
No.
No?
Nah.
Well, then how sincere are you? If decolonialization really means a recognition that the land was effectively stolen, that a form of genocide was inflicted on the people who justifiably can make the case legally now that they have a claim to the unceded territory. Why wouldn't you at least consider that seriously?
Well, because if I was to consider that seriously, that is, it boggles the mind what that would cost, not just to our brand, but just literally like reprinting stationery.
So there's a price tag on it.
There is a price tag. And yeah, there would be a, sorry, I couldn't resist that one. But yeah, there'd be a significant price tag. And not, you know, like I say, it would be to our brand. It would be to how many businesses have the name Vancouver in them? How many? I mean, it would boggle the mind. And I think it would really be, I don't want to say trivializing decolonization.
All right. Okay, I'm with you on that. But the statue,
the statue
of Vancouver,
Captain George on the. Again, I was he a genocidal maniac? I don't think he was. I think he but just discovered.
Definitely can be pointed to. He points to the beginning of colonization as it has any meaning at all.
Yeah, and again, I think that kind of tokenizes what decolonization and reconciliation really is about. I mean, we could take down a statue and still be treating our urban indigenous people poorly. And
I agree. It is an incredibly trivialization of it. Yeah. So I was obviously being provocative. But I am trying to get to what seriously decolonization means and how that can be, in the context of reconciliation, and unseated for that matter. These words are important.
Yeah.
But they're not clear.
Yeah, I think, actually, I've always been quite a fan of the term unseated territories, because I think that it reflects the fact that we are, less so on the stolen land, because I think stolen really has a bit more of a really negative connotation that is kind of provocative and inflames that kind of thing. But I think unceded recognizes that this land wasn't given to us. This wasn't something that we purchased fairly or anything. That I don't want to say ambiguity, but there's a history there that's not fully accounted for. And I think that is important to me. You know, it's interesting because we had this debate when there was a discussion about having a Vancouver Day to celebrate the incorporation of Vancouver. It got shot down, but the idea was to celebrate the incorporation of Vancouver and do it on Vanier Park. And there's, you know, very similar to that day is, or within a few months, was the Great Fire of Vancouver, which for many of us, we felt that was a more appropriate kind of symbol rather than the day that we kicked the celebrating Vanier Park, the day we kicked the Squamish off Snoq, basically, because that was the railway incorporation and the ceding that to the railway. Rather than celebrating that day, why don't we celebrate the day that Vancouver was born out of this fire? And because it was the same year, and the Squamish people got into canoes and came across Burrard Inlet to save these colonials who would later, you know, visit grave injustices on their people, but at the time, they came together and saved folks. And I think that's, in fact, that was just because I was just struck by, we were on our industrial tour. There's a great mural down at, I guess it's like Glenn and Powell or around that area. And it's of that, the canoes racing across Burrard Inlet with burning buildings in the background. And
right.
It's really powerful
image. So a moment of unity for the city.
Yeah. Yeah. And an acknowledgement of the relationship and the history and, you know, and it's pretty powerful for me to consider, to contemplate that the Squamish people who were about to, if they didn't realize it then, they must have had some sinking suspicion that this can't be good, that these guys are showing up with this giant railway and they're, you know, and they're parceling off our lands and they're kicking us off our reservation they're kicking us out of our village. But yet they still came across the water in their canoes to save people when they saw them in trouble. And that's powerful to me.
Yeah.
I am still struck by a moment I had at the British Columbia Museum when I was young and realized for the first time that smallpox had killed, in some cases, 90% of the people who occupied this place. And I couldn't even begin to imagine what that would do. And they'd already been through that. I think all the trauma that the culture and the people have suffered since was relatively minor compared to what smallpox did. And that came with the Europeans.
And of malicious intent as well. That wasn't, you know. And I mean, I think, I'm not sure that was, I mean, it's been an ongoing series of injustices.
So what does
even
that
today,
mean in
right
the context?
Now, when I go back to the down, you know, when I.
How do we then move from a sense of grievance, injustice, the context of re-adjudicating, retrying the past, the bombs, the rhetorical bombs that are being dropped, like genocide, and move towards a sophisticated relationship with what may be the biggest developers of the city, fundamentally shaping this place, regardless of what city plan says. MST development is going to be the biggest player, conceivably, particularly given how council's demonstrated real reluctance to deal with a rate of change beyond even modestly what we're considering at the moment. So if indeed they can move forward with projects that we scale in the thousands, if not tens of thousands, and the value that flows, does that constitute sufficient and effect reparations with a what will be increasingly sophisticated developer and a relationship that's going to be, in that sense, really fundamentally different looking into the future than the one that we look to in the past? Every time an elder appears at the beginning, it really is a reflection of the culture of the past. But this one, this relationship, this is about building, physically building the city on a scale that can only be compared to, well, Li Ka-shing and Concord Pacific. It's sure. At that scale.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why, you know, our efforts in reconciliation have to be genuine if we're going to have an authentic partnership and work together. I mean, because even though they are not obliged to work together with us, I think that they are willing to do that. And that's a great opportunity.
How could it be any other way?
I think it can be. I mean, I think...
Well, if it is, then we really are looking at not providing the services. We won't fight your fires. We won't even provide you water if there's no...
Water, sewer, roads, infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
How can you shape the city, extract the wealth, be unaccountable to the voters, but say basically you'll do what you want? We're going to be talking to Wade Grant. I want to get into this, but I don't see that as remotely constructive.
Well, I don't think anybody.
And so I don't think it'll happen.
But I think
on the other hand, I still see a discussion of reconciliation being something that looks backward into an idealized picture of whatever call it what you will.
I very much disagree with that. I think reconciliation is looking forward. In fact, it's recognizing and sort of atoning for the past, but also charting a path forward and how we can move out. I mean, it's irrefutable that, you know, the majority of homeless folks are indigenous. The majority of people, you know, like 2% of the population is indigenous in Vancouver, but 10% in the downtown east side. You know, the rates of poverty, of addiction, of child seizures, all these things are ongoing today, right now. So we have to be taking reconciliation forward and looking into the future and how we can make things better. And this is our moment to do that. And we can't do that without recognizing the past. We can't do that without recognizing the legacy of residential schools and displacement of land.
Right.
And, you know, I would say...
And how some of that financial load will have to be shared.
Well, and I mean that, you know, when we talk about the MST, it's important to recognize that the MST are the local First Nations, but we have a much larger urban indigenous population.
Yep.
And they have... And that's where the national frame comes in as well, right? Because these are, you know, First Nations people from across this land, and they're here now, and it's not their territory, but we need to sort of navigate that space as well. There was an interesting dynamic with the survivor totem pole in Pigeon Park, because it's a Haida pole. And it had been pointed out, it's like, well, right. this is you know, Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh territory, not Haida. Haida were not our friends back in the day. There was, you know, some...
Yeah.
You know, so that's also part of reconciliation and decolonization and recognizing, well, not all First Nations are the same. And an urban indigenous population of Métis, these are complicated. It's not just a...
Hey, Pete Fry.
Yeah.
What does identity mean to you?
What does identity mean to me?
Are you a settler?
You
see yourself that way?
Wrong guy. I feel like, you know...
Are you part of the colonial project?
Well, it's funny because I describe myself as a mutt, and people get really offended when I say that. But I take mutt, like, I'm a dog guy, and I think mutts are great.
Yeah. Why are you a mutt?
They're smarter.
Well, I'm of mixed race ancestry, and my mom's family is incredibly mixed and from a very colonial background where they were, like, basically imported laborers to work in sugarcane plantations, and a history of colonialism and globalism. You know, so all these kind of components. And, you know, my father's family is British, and they probably were slave traders at some point. I mean, there's this
You're complex, perfect.
There's
You're
this perfect complex Vancouver relationship. Ride. Yeah. And right. I feel like I'm not Caucasian. I know that I'm not white because I'll, you know, but I'm at the same time, I'm not really of any, you know.
You are the perfect Vancouverite, I think.
Yeah, I can flow through well. All sorts of different, you know. I could be Mexican.
I'm still stunned by one basic demographic fact in this town. 52% of the people, all the people, all 600 and some thousand, are, quote, people of color.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
I am way the visible minority.
You certainly are heading that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
do I have a voice?
You do have a voice.
Will I be respected?
I think so. Yeah. Well, I mean, what, you personally? Of course, yeah.
No, it's an old white guy.
Yeah, the old white guy will have the voice for a long time.
And hey, old white guys, like
there's hope. Middle-aged white guys, too.
Thank you, Pete.
What should we be looking for? Give us a preview of where you think, after you come back from your summer break, where what like, nice meaty subjects we should be thinking about so that we can kind of get into the sizzle.
Hmm. Well, I mean, we'll see some reporting back on new housing approaches and rental housing stuff. That'll be pretty interesting because there's definitely an appetite to see what we can squeeze out. I think we'll see a lot more movement on directions around Pearson Dogwood and that whole sort of like that area. There's a lot of new direction coming from there and actually some pretty interesting direction from the developers who are looking to find ways to achieve deeper affordability.
Yeah.
And that'll come with trade-offs, you know, more density.
Well, I said if about half a year ago, I think the housing crisis, as we have known and not liked it, in a sense is over. The prices have, at the high end, have stabilized. Things are beginning to shift. Money is flowing from senior governments. Projects are underway. New possibilities. You've named some of them. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
We should be thinking maybe more positively that we really actually can get a hold of this one.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with this council and how we work together. And that we are, I mean, there's an incredible amount of thoughtfulness. And I mean, if you're paying attention, it's like we don't even vote along party lines half the time.
Right.
You know, there's a real different way of doing things. And people are taking the time to hear what the other person's saying and actually think about it. And it's not, we're not immediately knee-jerk reacting. It's like, oh, well, the NPA said that, so I can't possibly agree with it. Or, you know, I mean, the fact that we had the entire council unanimously come in behind the climate emergency kind of stuff is amazing and inconceivable in many respects.
Perhaps you could say the NPA not being unified makes them a less formidable force for you guys and you don't feel as threatened?
No, you know, the funny thing is that they can still pull it together and be like an NPA voting bloc when they have to be.
Okay.
And we've seen that.
Okay.
Let's bring them up here and we'll do a little meat and sizzle. Hey, thank you for...
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah,
you did pretty good on that one. And we let you off the hook. Did not grill you on that incredibly unfortunate vote on the townhouses on Cranston.
The Shaughnessy
Street.
Town?
Oh.
I stand by that one, you know, because... Okay, you brought it up. You can't cut me off now. You brought it up.
All right.
And so Michael Wiebe and I both talked to staff at the time because we generally did not have a problem with the townhouse. We didn't have a problem with rental in Shaughnessy. We didn't have a problem with the price point. The issue was the property line to property line, 20-foot deep excavation for... You know, double the amount of parking.
That only tells us there ain't a housing crisis. Come on, dude.
No.
That was your concern.
No, it was. So it was the impact.
What
of
did
the
you
construction.
Think the next day when you woke up and saw in the paper that the hospice wanted to actually buy the land to do the same effective kind of?
Well, my first thought was like, that's horrible. But then I talked, and they're like, you know what? That's the media talking because. No. Mark my words, they're coming back with...
We'll see. I mean, time will tell what's going to
happen. They're coming back
there.
with another...
A big single-family
dwelling. Because, quite frankly, that excavation alone was the single... Because, I mean, you've seen excavation sites, 20 feet deep. It's better part of a year. This is a hospice where the average stay is 30 days. We've got four hospices in the city. They serve a critical function.
The message you sent out was, good news, you can disregard policy and plans... So long as you can put together a heartwarming case.
It was a pivotal moment in this council.
That interim housing choices policy is very discretionary at best. Like it lays it out pretty discretionary. And that was an exceptional circumstances. And I thought we clearly articulated that was the rationale. That was the exceptional circumstances of the proximity to the hospice, to an active hospice.
All right. Hey, Pete. All right. Pete, you're great. Thank you for joining us today.
I don't think we sizzled them enough.
No, we didn't.
There's always
to have them back.
All right, let's do it again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you.